Okay, good evening, everybody. Today is Monday, January 8th, and we are here at United Orthodox Synagogues, and we are beginning our series on Masters of the Mishnah, the life and times of the rabbis of the Mishnah. And we actually have a fascinating story today about someone who is not very well known and does not have a lot of mention in the Talmud. But the story, the main story about him in the Talmud is fascinating and raises all sorts of questions. And his name is Reuven ben Itzdrubali, or Itzdrubuli. And just before we get into a discussion about him, just a public service note, there's no class next Monday, unless you're going to be in Orlando, which is where I will be. And so if you find me, I will gladly study with you. But if you're not going to be in Orlando next Monday, I'm out of luck. Okay. You're in luck, I'm out of luck. Okay? But I'm not going to tell you what hotel I'm in, because I don't really want you to find me. Okay. I'm sorry about that. I did not realize this when I made the schedule. Okay, so Rabbi Reuven ben Itzdrubuli is a Tana. The Tanaim are the rabbis of the Mishnah. They are often mentioned in the Mishnah. They're also mentioned in the Talmud, but they are the rabbis of the Mishnah. They are the authors of the Mishnah. And the Mishnaic period goes from the year 40 to the year 200, okay? And that's the range of the Tanaitic period. And there are different generations of the Tanaitic period. There's a debate as to how many generations there were of the Tanaitic period. But essentially, most authorities say that there are four generations of the Tanaitic period, and Rabbi Reuven ben Itzdrubuli was in the fourth generation. So he's what we would call a late Tana, and we don't know that much about him. But generally speaking, the Tanas of the fourth generation lived in northern Israel. This is the map of Israel. They lived in northern Israel, up here in this neck of the woods. What we know as the Galil, the Galilee, Tveria, Tzfat, that area. And things got worse and worse for the Jews, right, in Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple, etc., they started migrating north. And if you go to Israel today, a lot of the Tanaim are, you could visit many of the graves of the Tanaim. Okay, so we don't know where he lived. We don't know that much about him at all. But we do have this one fascinating story, plus another mention of him in one or two other places. And hopefully, we'll be able, using some detective work and maybe surmising or assuming certain things, right? We'll be able to piece together some sort of understanding of his personality and the type of man that he was. Okay, so let's start with the most famous story about him, which is the story which is on page. This is very high tech. This is too high tech for me because it's also got like stickies here. Yeah. This is very complicated.
Ask your kids though.
Yeah. So we have a story in Masechet Me'ila on Daf Yud Zayin Amud Bet, which tells a story of the time when the Roman government had some decrees against the Jews in terms of how they were allowed or how they were not allowed to practice Judaism. Right. This we're all familiar with, that over the course of the Roman rule in Israel, right, there were many gezerot, many decrees against the Jews in terms of how they were going to how they're allowed to to practice Judaism. Okay? And this is one of those cases. But what's interesting here is what Rav Reuven ben Istrabuli did about it. So the story is, for the government had once issued a decree that Jews might not keep the Sabbath, circumcise their children, and that they should have intercourse with menstruant women. I'm not quite sure how they would force the third thing. Okay? But nonetheless, it probably means they shut down the mikvahs. Right? That's probably what it means. But in any case, this was the decree of the Roman government. Okay? So this Rabbi Reuven Istrabuli, the Gemara says, thereupon, Rabbi Reuven, the son of Istrabuli, cut his hair in the Roman fashion and went and sat among them. Right? So this is actually very interesting. He infiltrated. Right? He went to Rome, it sounds like. Or maybe he didn't go to Rome, maybe infiltrated the government in Palestine at the time. However, some understand that he actually went to Rome and infiltrated the highest echelons of Roman government, presenting himself as a Gentile. So he's essentially a spy. Okay, and he's going to try to figure this out. And he does this by cutting his hair in the Roman way, which I think, if I recall correctly, it's called, there's another Gemara that I have, which we'll get to in a little while. It's called a komi, kuf vav mem yud, not to be confused with the comb over, right? This is the komi, Hebrew word, right? I don't know why I'm thinking about that. So he gets this Roman haircut, and he goes to sit. He goes to them, and not only does he infiltrate them, now he tries to sort of trick them into thinking that their idea is actually a bad idea. Right? Let's see what he does. He said to them, "If a man has an enemy, what does he wish him? To be poor or rich?" They said that he be poor. He said to them, "If so, let them do no work on the Sabbath, so that they grow poor." Okay, this sounds almost like too good to be true. Like, how dumb could the Romans be that they fall for this? But they said, "He speaketh rightly. Let this decree be annulled." So he saved the Shabbat. Now the Jews could rest on the Shabbat because the Romans thought it would make them poor. It was indeed annulled. Then he continued, "If one has an enemy, what does he wish him? To be weak or healthy?" They answered, "Weak." He said, "Let the children be circumcised at the age of 8 days, and they will be weak." They said, "He speaketh rightly," and it was annulled. This, like, now we're getting like into Chelm. Like, this almost sounds like Wise Men of Chelm material, okay? My famous Wise Men of Chelm story is about the road that was very dangerous, very sharp road, and whenever someone would ride around the road too fast, they would fall off the side of the cliff. And so the people, the wise men of Chelm, built a hospital on the bottom of the cliff. Right? So this sounds like very weird, okay? So they said, "He speaketh right." It was annulled. And then finally he said to them, "If one has an enemy, what does he wish him? To multiply or to decrease?" They said that he decreases. "If so, let them have no intercourse with menstruant women." Right? The less intercourse, the less sex, the less kids. Presto changeo, fewer Jews. And they're like, "That sounds like a great idea." They said, "He speaketh rightly," and it was annulled. Okay? So, if we just stop here, setting aside the simplicity of his arguments, this is pretty gutsy. Right? We have this rabbi. He's a Tana. He's not just a guy. He's not a regular citizen. He's apparently known in his community, and he's highly thought of to the extent that they're willing to trust him to send him as an emissary so that he could go to Israel, to Rome. Right? He's highly thought of, so he could go to Rome and act as an emissary. And then I really think it sounds like, to me, like he puts his life on the line, or to some degree, right? He's putting himself in danger because, it doesn't say that he was an emissary of the Jews who occasionally went before the Roman government to argue on behalf of the Jews. That happened. There's another famous story I'll get to in a second. That happened, and then the Romans knew that they were Jewish, and if they bought the argument or if they brought enough bribes, then they would relax the decrees. But this was very different, right? This was a situation where it sounds like, at first glance, he was really pretending to be a Roman, which is why he cut his hair, right? If he was going to be known as a Jew, then he wouldn't cut his hair. He would just show up with his Jewish haircut and his Jewish clothing in front of them. But here he's infiltrating them, and so I just think that's sort of an outstanding, like it's like an act of heroism, right? And worthy of note. Okay, so everything seems to be going great. Later they came to know that he was a Jew, right? Which also proves the point that at first they didn't know that he was a Jew, and I was expecting that they would kill him. Right? I was fully expecting that they would kill him. The Talmud does not record that. What did they do? Later they came to know that he was a Jew, and the decrees were reinstituted. The Jews then conferred as to who should go to Rome to work for the annulment of the decrees. And then they're going to send a Jew, who's clearly Jewish, to try to plead their case. Yeah.
He wouldn't have stayed around, would he? He did his job. They took it back.
Oh, so I see what you're saying. Meaning when it says that they came to know that he was a Jew, someone tipped him off later on. Meaning he got on a boat, went back to Tzfat, did a little water skiing on the Kinneret, and then they found out. Oh, that's interesting. You know what? Didn't even occur to me that when I read the Gemara that was possible. Okay.
And they still later. Control. I mean, they still could have
hunted him down.
Punished him in some way.
Yeah,
but how much later did they find
right,
out?
Right, but Carol's saying it wasn't like in the throne room.
Got it.
That guy's a Jew, right? And then there's a whole chase until they catch him, right? No. So right. So that's I didn't even consider that possible. Yeah, that's entirely possible, and they reinstituted the decrees. As I was mentioning earlier, we do have examples of Jews who went before the Romans as Jews, right? One of the most, where they didn't have to cut their hair, or one of the most famous stories.
Should we understand it? I'm sorry for speaking out. As
no, please.
Pretending he cut his hair in the Roman fashion. Why do we assume that he has an assumed identity? That seems pretty fanciful, because the Romans were very class conscious. Like, they had names that specified their lineage. He would have to make that up.
Interesting.
And it would have to be believable. I think that would be almost harder to do in Roman society than it would be in ours.
Wow. Okay. It could be. The reason why I assume that is because the fact that he cut his hair, right? Meaning, why does the Gemara have to go out of its way to tell us that he got a Roman haircut?
When in Rome, do as the Romans do. They like it.
So you think it was, but it says later they came to know that he was a Jew. So even the Gemara's assumption is that he was hiding his identity, right? This is like Esther, right? She's hiding her identity. He was hiding his identity. Yeah. Although that's a very good question. What else did he have to do, right? We'll see later discussion. Was there different Roman clothing than there was Jewish clothing? Maybe he had to come up with some sort of, you know, fake passport, right, or the equivalent of, with a fake name, a fake history, right? Yeah, could be. Yeah.
No, I was just going to say they obviously didn't know he was a Jew, because they say afterwards they
right.
realized
right.
it. That's
right. So one of the most famous Jews who appeared before the Romans, but not as a Roman, was Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. Right? We've studied this story before in our Shabbat class. I'll tell you the story outside. If you want to read it quickly, it's a long story. It's on page 3, 4, 5, and 6. It's a long story. It starts sort of on the bottom of page 3. Those the bottom Hebrew and bottom English paragraph. This is the famous story of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who realized, this is at the beginning of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. This is before our friend Rabbi Reuven ben Itzterbuli. He realized that Jerusalem's going to be sacked. The Romans are going after it. And there's two choices. Fight and likely lose, and then everyone's going to die. Or try to come up with some sort of scheme that will at least save something of Judaism and the Jews and Jewish life. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he fakes his death, his own death, and he's snuck out of Jerusalem in a coffin. And on his way out, there's a whole tense moment where they want to spear through the coffin just to make sure that it's not a ploy, and they're convinced not to do it. And he's ultimately smuggled out of Jerusalem in a coffin, and he stands before Vespasian, who at that point was not the emperor. Vespasian at that point was the head of the legion, whatever legion it was, that was in charge of the land. He was the general, right? And what he says to Vespasian is actually, he calls him the Caesar. And he says as follows, if you want to look up page 5, he says to him, on the bottom of page 4 actually, he says, when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai reached there, the Roman camp, he said, "Greetings to you, the king. Greetings to you, the king." Vespasian said to him, "You are liable for 2 death penalties. One, because I am not the king, and yet you call me the king. And furthermore, if I am the king, why didn't you come to me until now?" Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said to him, "As for what you said about yourself, I'm not the king. In truth, you are king. If not now, then in the future. And if you are not a king, Jerusalem will not be handed over into your hand, as it's written, etc., etc." And then what happens next is that a messenger comes in right away and tells Vespasian that the emperor had died and he was next in line to become the emperor. So he actually was king. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was prophetic, and Vespasian says, "Okay, I like you. I got to go back to Rome to take up my role as Caesar, but what do you want? I'll give you something." And he says, Tainli, famous words, Tainli Yavne v'chachameha. Give me the city of Yavne and its wise men, which ultimately saved Judaism, because he was able to rebuild and actually created rabbinic Judaism. But you have to remember, this is the first time that Judaism is going to exist outside of the temple, without a Beit HaMikdash, without Karbanot, without all the pomp and circumstance. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai has to create Jewish life in a way that was unknown before. I bring that up as a counterexample to what our subject, Rav Reuven ben Itzterbuli, did, which was different, right? Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai appeared to Vespasian as a Jew, while this fellow, Reuven ben Itzterbuli, infiltrates the Roman government pretending to not be a Jew, okay? So what else do we know about this Rabbi Reuven Itzterbuli? So I will call your attention to page number 8 in our source book. It's too big?
Yeah, it's too big.
Sorry about that. Okay. There's a story. This Gemara in context is talking about the prohibition of studying Greek wisdom. It was considered to be dangerous, heretical, and so it was prohibited. But the Gemara says, what about the house of Rabban Gamliel? They studied Greek wisdom. So the Gemara says they're different. And that's where we pick up the top of the page. Shane shel Beit Rabban Gamliel dikrovin lamalchut hayu. So they're different. They're not like every other Jew. They are close to the monarchy. Now this term, krovin lamalchut, I'm going to highlight it using my new highlight. Careful. Is a halachic term, karov lamalchut, which refers to a Jewish person who as a Jew has access to the foreign governments. And in order to be able to sort of work and be comfortable in the working environment of the Gentile governments, is allowed to take certain liberties that a regular Jew is not allowed to take. One would be studying Greek wisdom, and let's continue. D'tanya, misaper komi hare ze midarkei amori. For example, cutting your hair in the komi style, which was a Gentile fashion, is considered to be a violation of the prohibition of mimicking the Gentiles, right? There's a category in halacha that we have that you're not allowed to mimic the Gentiles. So getting a haircut like the Gentiles is a violation of that. But, however, the rabbis, the Gemara says, Avtolus ben Reuven hetiru lesaper komi. Avtolus, the son of Reuven, they allowed him, the rabbis allowed him to cut his hair in this komi style. Why? Shehu karav l'malchut. That because he was close to the monarchy. Shabbei Rabban Gamliel hetiru lehen chachmat yivanit mipnei shekrovin l'malchut. Similarly, they permitted the house of Rabban Gamliel to study Greek wisdom because they are close to the monarchy. Now, Jonas, this comes to your point. Because according to some people, our friend Reuven ben Itzrabuli is the same guy as Avtolus ben Reuven. Right, there are some commentaries of the Talmud who say these two are the same people. You could certainly understand why you would say that. The stories are very similar. But there's one major distinction, which I think leads other commentaries to say they're not the same people. What's that distinction?
One goes as a Jew and one doesn't.
Right. This guy on page 8, Reuven ben Avtolus ben Reuven, we say he has the status of being Karov l'Malchut, close to the monarchy. That's a Jewish position. That's a known Jew. That is Jared Kushner. Okay? That's a known Jew. Yes, but both of them a little bit. Right. Avtolus ben Reuven sounds Greek, which actually makes Jonas strengthens your point that maybe he took on, right? Maybe he used or took on a Greek name so that it'd be more comfortable for him to, you know, walk the halls of power. Okay, so there's a debate. Some say they're the same people, right? However, as I noted. It could be the same people, but these may be different stories, right? Mm-hmm. Because in our story, the original, he goes out of his way not to be recognized as a Jew. That's why he got the haircut. In the other way, he didn't get a haircut to avoid being recognized as a Jew. He just got that haircut to make it more comfortable for him, right? So instead of every time he walks into a room, someone doesn't say, "Hey, why do you have that funny haircut?" And he does, right? He's sort of on an equal playing field in terms of fashion with everybody else. So it could be the same person, but it seems like it's a different story because in our case, what's that?
I think it's the same person.
And which story do you think came first?
It's a good question. Maybe they were emphasizing different aspects of it.
Right. It could be.
If he's close to the monarchy, why would he have to pretend not to be a Jew after that?
Some others can suggest that Avtolus on page 8 is Reuven's son. Now that to me is a very compelling possibility, right? Because this guy is sort of doing what his father did, but without the same risk. Right, meaning this is a family that likes to be involved in politics, intrigue. This is a family that likes to be involved with the foreign governments on behalf of their own people. But my father really almost bought it when he did it as a spy. So I'm not going to do it as a spy. I'm going to do it as a diplomat.
Is Istrabuli
It sounds Greek.
Sound like
it's
a
Greek to me.
Hebrew name.
Right, so it could be the same as similar to Aftulus. Right, so it could be that Reuven ben Itzrabuli is really Reuven ben the other way around. Yeah, yeah. Sometimes these names get confused. In any case, so I like that one, meaning I like the version that sees them as father and son, because they're really in the same line of work, but with a slight pivot towards something which is, you know, more sustainable and much less dangerous.
Nowhere do you have dates on this?
No.
Google it.
It's hard to know. Yeah, yeah. Now, if you look on the page 8 on the right side, there's a little section called personalities. Aftulus ben Reuven. Some identify him as Avtolomus, who was one of the teachers of Rabbi Yossi. So that would also tell us when he lived. It is not known when he lived. It may be that he had a connection with Rav Reuven ben Itzrabuli, that's our guy, about whom it is told that he would dress and style his hair like the Gentiles in order to spend time in the halls of power trying to avert decrees against the Jewish people. Aftulus ben Reuven seems to have filled a similar function, but again, in a different way. Okay? So we don't really know, but it's sort of cool to think that this is like a family business, right? Trying to work amongst the Goyim to help your own people. One as a spy, and then one as a, we'll call it a diplomat. Now, just going back to this notion of Karov Lemalchut, a few years ago, this became a major, to the extent that you could call a story that only modern Orthodox people know about to be major. This was a major story, right, in the modern Orthodox world when President Obama was elected. I think it was the first time, so it's actually quite a while ago now. He had a day of prayer at a church, at the National Cathedral, I think. And a prominent Orthodox rabbi was invited to go. And the fundamental position of most Orthodox authorities is you don't go into churches. But this rabbi accepted the invitation and went. And after the fact, it was a big scandal. Again, to the extent that only people who read the Jewish Week knew about this, but it was a big scandal, right? The New York Jewish Week, right? It was a big scandal. So what happened? Afterwards, there was another prominent rabbi who came to this first rabbi's defense and saying, no, he had every right to do that. Karov Lamalchut, meaning the president has invited you. You're going to have a chance to speak to him. Maybe you could whisper in his ear something about Israel. Maybe you could whisper in his ear something that's good for the Jews. And maybe it'll have an effect on how he governs. So even though normally it's a biblical violation to get the Comey haircut, this guy, both of these people did it. And even though it would be a violation in their eyes to enter into a church, Karov L'Malchut allows you to do things that the rest of us are not allowed to do. But if you're Karov L'Malchut, you are allowed to do it. And the reason you're allowed to do it, I'll show you inside before we get back to Rav Reuven ben Itzrabuli, we'll read the Rambam first. On the bottom of page 1, the Rambam says, Ein holchin b'chukot ha'ovdei kochavim. You're not allowed to walk in the ways of the Gentiles. V'lo midamin lahen. And you're not allowed to mimic them or imitate them. Listen to the Rambam says, Lo b'malbush v'lo b'sear. Not in the way they dress and not in the way they cut their hair. I remember a few years ago, when Sarah Palin was the vice presidential candidate, all of a sudden, this is amazing, there were all these Sarah Palin-styled shaitels. Do you remember this? It was a big thing. Yeah. Right? So, I mean, she's a serious Gentile, right? She is, right? And you wonder, all these shaitel makers are doing the Sarah Palin. I guess they missed this Gemara, this Rambam.
She had a flag in her office.
Right, yeah, right. But maybe if you wore her hair, it was like you were Karov L'Malchut, because like you became Sarah Palin. Okay, anyway, so you're not allowed to you're not allowed to be like them. You're not allowed to imitate them in what they wear or in their hair, right? And this is a Torah violation. However, the Rambam says, if you turn the page, on page 2, the next Hebrew section, Yisrael shayak harov l'malchut v'tzarich leishev lefnei malcheihem v'hayalo ginai l'fishelo yidmelehen. An Israelite of an idolatrous king's circle who must sit in council with their kings, and he feels ashamed to appear different than they, may wear their kind of clothes and shave opposite his face as they do. That's a direct result of our Gemara. Now, it's interesting. Our friend, Rabbi Reuven Estrabuli, has an entirely different reason why he's allowed to get the fake haircut, which is why?
He's acting as a spy.
He's acting as a spy. It's going to save his life, right? If he shows up trying to be a spy with a shtreimel, right, and his tzitzis out and his payas, it's not going to be a very good spy. He's not going to be very successful, right? So, but even if you're not a spy and you're clearly a Jew, right, you're allowed to do this. And then one of the commentaries, the Kesef Mishnah, which is on page 2, written by Yosef Karo, says in Hebrew, Vim Tomar, Kevan Shakatav Rabbeinu, Sheloke al kol echad me'elu, the punishment for violating the prohibition of mimicking the Gentiles is lashes. How could the rabbis just come along and say, you're not allowed to dress like a Gentile, but you can because you have a date with the president? Right? Right? I mean, how do they get to do that?
Like Rembrandt.
Right?
The
how do they get to do that?
Well,
so he says,
she is speaking to a person in power.
Exactly. That's what he says. V'yesh lomar mishum hatzalat Yisrael. What's at stake is saving Jews' lives. Disharu. That's why they allowed it. U'kashi Yisraelim omdim lefnei hamalachim heimatzlim et Yisrael. And whenever there's a chance for a Jew to stand within the power circle of a king, that can save Jews' lives. It's also interesting. It's such insecurity. Right? You think about this. I mean, maybe it's the same now. We have AIPAC, and we have all sorts of things that we do to try to get a friendly president, a Jew-friendly president, an Israel-friendly president. Right? There's just still this sense of insecurity. He says the language is so powerful. When a Jew stands before a king, that saves Jewish lives. Another answer, Inami, Shatara lo pirta davar. This is actually a very fascinating approach. He says another explanation of how a Jew is allowed to break this Torah rule in order to more comfortably walk in the halls of power. He says, really, the Torah said, don't walk in the ways of the Gentiles. I mean, don't copy the Gentiles. Umasra hadavar lechachamim, but how that rule is to be applied was given over to the rabbis. Meaning the Jews got a general category, but the rabbis get to decide how that category is applied, and they didn't apply it to people who are diplomats. It wasn't that it was applied to everyone, and then a diplomat is carved out. It was never applied to the diplomats at all, because the rabbis who were given license to apply the rule as they see fit. It's almost like saying the federal government says there must be a speed limit. And now each state, you decide what the speed limit's going to be. Okay? Or some other, like example. Okay. So that's this notion of karov l'malchut. That's why the rabbi from the other Gemara that we saw in Masechet Sota, Avtulus ben Reuven from the house of Rabban Gamliel was allowed to get a haircut. And it also explains to a degree why our friend, Rav Reuven Estrabuli, maybe the father of this other rabbi, also did something similar. Okay. That's one story about Rav Reuven Estrabuli and how this other person, Avtulus ben Reuven, is this same person or his son. Or not related at all. We have another time when we met Rav Reuven Estrabuli, maybe. And this is on page 9. And if this is him, then we're seeing another dimension of this rabbi. Okay, what do you guys smirking about?
If it were he.
I'm sorry.
You asked. You asked. You asked.
What did you do?
I did not use.
I'm sorry.
My English wasn't goodly. I spoketh wrongly words.
Fine.
Yes. I should have sat on the other side. Yeah.
We speak about the way Romans cut their hair and whatever. Does that mean, and I don't mean to be funny here or whatever, what did they not have baldness at that time?
They did, but not everyone was bald. So if you weren't bald, I guess you had a certain type of haircut.
Also, they shaved. They had clean.
They were clean shaven.
The haircuts were based upon the army, the soldiers. They didn't want the hair to be long enough that it could be grabbed and pulled. So your status in Rome, originally it came through that. So
were you a Roman subject at one point? And you're back here like as a Gilgul? You know a lot about this.
I like it.
Because you and my son, you study Roman mythology together.
So they would cut their hair short. At this time, this is after Caesar, so Caesar's haircut would probably have been very common. He was balding, and he said comb over, but he did brush it.
Right. So the comb I saw described somewhere where they cut most of their front hair, and they only had like a patch in the back. Again, maybe because they wanted to pull their hair from the front. I don't know.
So that was the idea behind
different haircuts.
Short hair.
Interesting. Okay, so according to some, the Rabbi Reuven, who's named in this story, is Rav Reuven Itzhtrebuli. Page 9. This is a Tosefta. A Tosefta is a Talmudic statement of Mishnaic vintage, which did not make it into the collection of Mishnayot. Okay, it's a separate collection, not studied as widely, but very important. And for our case, we may meet him again. So it says, Pamachat Shavat Rav Reuven B'Tveria. One time, Rav Reuven, again, who some people say is Rav Reuven Itzhtrebuli, who either before or after this time infiltrated the Roman government, was sitting in Tveria, or lived in Tveria. Matso Philosoph, a philosopher found him. Amar lo, Ezehu Sanui Sheba Olam. The philosopher asked Rav Reuven, what's the most hated thing in the world? Okay? And what he meant is, to your God, what's the most hated thing in the world? That's how the commentaries understand this. So I'm not sure if the philosopher is trying to cause trouble. Maybe he's trying to enter into a real conversation. But what's interesting just is that he felt that this Rabbi Reuven was wise enough and representative enough of the Jewish tradition to ask him this question. So again, it sort of gives us a sense of who this man was. Now we know two things about him. That one, well, we know a few things. He was very brave, and that his community thought he was an appropriate person to, and he was wise enough and smart enough and clever enough to be the one who infiltrated the Roman government. And this philosopher felt that he was smart enough and knew enough and represented Judaism, so he could ask him, that's a serious question. What does God hate most in the world? Let's take a poll. Jonas, what does God hate most in the world?
Sin.
That's a good answer, but quite vague. Okay, Rhoda? Murder. Now narrowing it down. One of the three biggies.
Yeah.
Okay.
Lashon Hara.
All right, Lashon Hara.
Molestation.
Okay.
Idolatry.
Hatred.
All right. These are all excellent answers.
I think really the answer to it is Hashem also said he did not like other gods.
Yeah, God really does not like other gods. That is true. I think that may be the answer, by the way. That's Rav Reuven's answer, okay? Yes, he clearly does not like pretenders to the throne, okay? Here's what Rav Reuven said. Pamachat Shavat Rav Ruben B'Tveria Matso Filosaf Amar Lo Ezehu Sanoi Bolam Amar Lo Ze Hakofer B'Misha Baro. Very close to what you said, Ron. A person who denies his creator, meaning that there is no God. Okay, which is not as bad probably as saying there are other gods, but bad.
Right.
There is no God.
That's a weird answer. That sounds like a different answer.
Then what?
Other gods.
Yes, it's different than other gods. Yeah. I'm just, yeah, it is, for sure.
Right, because it's actually interesting because it's also, we all, most all picked things that people do to people.
Mm-hmm.
This is something just between us and God.
Right.
I mean, nobody
right.
else
Wait, you
knows.
Got you guys are on the ball.
And you can't That's force good. Someone.
Right.
Right, you guys are on the ball. So how to read this Tosefta is not 100% clear, but it seems like the next frit.
Is that what we think it means, atheism? To deny one's creator?
Hakofer b'misha bar'o, to deny the one who created him. So that means, I think that means to deny God.
So what, it's the same shorash as, you know, like Kippur,
Kapara. But Kapara is, right, l'chaper is to wash away. So you're right, maybe that's why. I'm not 100% sure if that's true or not, but yeah. Okay, so Hakofer, like someone, he's a kofer, he's a heretic. He's denying God. So then this philosopher says, Ezehu, which seems to be like, he can't believe that Rav Ruvein Itzhabuli gave this answer. He says that's self-serving, is what some of the commentaries say. Of course you're going to say that. Because you want everyone to believe in your God. It's almost like saying the question that was mentioned. What about don't kill? I mean, that's... I mean, if you're talking... This is interesting, right? Maybe the philosopher meant what's the most hated thing in terms of without it, society will fall apart. Maybe that's the philosopher's question. And Rav Ruvein Itzhabuli is understanding it differently. But in an incredulous way, the philosopher says, what are you talking about? And then Reuven answers him on the last page. He says, listen, Kaved et avicha, lo tirtzach, lo tinaf, lo tignov, lo tanev rechad, lo tachmod. All these interpersonal stuff, honoring your parents, don't kill, don't commit adultery, don't steal, all that stuff. Deha ein adam kofer b'davar ad shekofer b'ikar. This is actually an interesting philosophy of religion. He says, no one would do those other things without first denying God. And if you really believe that there's a God, not just that there is a God, right? The Jewish idea is not that just there is a God, but there's a God who cares about what you do, who rewards and who punishes, and who knows, and the God is the one who sets the rules, you wouldn't steal. If you believed in that God, you wouldn't kill. You wouldn't be an adulterer. You would honor your parents, right? Rav Ruvein is expressing a particular approach to religion, which is we'd all basically be a bunch of animals if not for God. Now, that's not the only Jewish approach, right? There are other approaches that say explicitly that there are some mitzvot, namely many of the interpersonal ones, that we would do anyway. That we would do anyway. Right? There are lots of people who don't believe in God but are nice to their moms.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And don't kill people.
Right? Now, you could make the argument that they're just living off of a vestige of when everyone did believe in God and that trickled down. Right? Not when everyone believed in God, but when so much of morality was framed in the context of religion, that they've built their life based off of an earlier era's approach to life without the theological baggage. But, or not. You could say, no, there are people who really, really, legitimately don't believe in God, and nonetheless, they've developed a moral code where they don't kill people and they are nice to their moms. But this is an interesting approach that he's taking, right? She ain adam kofer b'davar ad she kofer b'ikar. Ve'ein adam holech ledivar avera. A person does not walk to sin. Ela im kafar b'mishet sivahu la'aleha. Unless he has denied the person who commanded it, who commanded the sin. Again, I think it's a debatable point, but that is nonetheless Rabbi Reuven ben Itzhtrabuli's argument. Right? There's another Gemara that says, Ein adam chote ad shenichnas bo ruach shtut. A person only sins unless craziness has entered them. Meaning, it's not a religious argument. People may sin for other reasons, not because they're denying God. Right? We have categories of sin, which are some people sin to anger God. Some people sin because they deny God. And we have other categories where people sin l'teavon, because I need to have that cheeseburger. Yeah, I'm going to pay the price, but I can't overcome my
crime of passion.
Right. Right. So this is not the only view, but nonetheless, now we know a few other things about Rav Reuven Itzhtrabuli. He was highly thought of in terms of speaking to this philosopher, and this was sort of his approach to morality. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking, we had a class some years ago talking about the shul-going man who's stealing people's money in business, doing all kinds
right.
of bad things. Should he still be allowed to come to shul?
Right,
I mean,
right.
It just popped into my head when you were talking
right,
about
right,
that.
Right, right, right. There's fascinating responsa uh-huh. that talks about people who come to shul, but they're not Sabbath. They're not observant, fully observant. What's the status? And so it's been pointed out. It's fascinating. You can't. You're not going to say that they're heretics because they stand up in shul on Friday night and say, "Ki sheshet yamim asa adoshem et hashamayim v'et haaretz," that God created, and then they go eat a cheeseburger. Okay. Maybe those things are not mutually exclusive. Rabbi Reuven Itzhtrabuli is saying those things are mutually exclusive, and other people view it differently. Okay, so that's another thing that we know about him. Finally, two other statements by our friend. By the way, I'm willing to say that there are less than 5% of the Jews in the world that know about Rabbi Reuven Itzhtrabuli. So you have just entered very rarefied. Yeah, it is sad. He is a fascinating. And this is, by the way, this is it. I've given you everything. This is all there is in the Talmud about him, as far as I know. I'm not an expert in him, but I think this is it, as far as the research I've done. Okay, so what else do we know about him? We know two stories about him on the bottom of page 2. Hachi Amarav Mishum Rav Reuven Ben Itzhtrabuli. The English is on top of page 3. Rav said in the name of Rabbi Reuven Ben Itzhtrabuli as follows. Min ha-Torah u-min ha-Neviim u-min ha-Ketuvim. From the Torah, from the prophets, from the writings, it implies that the decree that a specific woman is destined to be married to a specific man is from God. What did he believe in? What do we call this? Bashert.
Yeah.
By the way, cards on the table, I do not believe in Bashert. If Bashert means that there's one man for one woman, I don't buy it. Because I don't buy it because what happens... Right. When someone dies and then they get remarried, which one of those was the Bashert? They're going to fight it. They're going to fight over that. Anyway, so.
Only Hashem.
Only Hashem. I don't buy it, but anyway, that's neither here nor there. Apparently, a greater man than I, Rabbi Reuven Itzhtrabuli, did believe in it. And he says he can prove it from verses in the Bible, in the prophets and in the writings, which is the rabbinic way of saying this is incontrovertible, because we've got all three, arms of the military, right? All three arms of the Torah proving it. Where do we have this? From where is it derived? From the Torah, Then Lavan and Betuel answered and said, this thing comes from the Lord. Right? When Yaakov took Rivka. Right? Okay. From the prophets, but his father and his mother knew not that it was the Lord. From the writings that is written, house and riches and the inheritance of fathers, but a prudent woman is from the Lord. Okay, so now we knew. Now, by the way, this actually very easily dovetails with his conversation with the philosopher. Right? Because for Rav Tzibuli, everything's about God. If you believe in God, you're going to be a good boy and a good girl. God is the one who makes the shidduch. Right? Everything is a function. There's a very high level of divine providence operating in your private life, and there's a very high need for belief in God if you want to live a moral life. So there is, a connection between those two. And then finally, we learn the following. I really would love to hear your take on this. V'yamar Rav Mishum Rav Ruven ben Etshabuli V'amri Labem Matnita Tana Amar Ruben Etshabuli. The Gemara teaches that Rav said the name of Rav Ruven Etshabuli, and some say that it was taught in a Braita that Rav Ruven Etshabuli said. Listen to this. This is okay. You tell me what you think. Ein Adam Nechshad B'Davar Ela Im Kein Asahu. Just think hashtag Me Too. A man is suspected of having done something wrong only if he has indeed done so. V'im lo asa kulo asa miktzato. If he's not guilty of what you're of the entire claim, then he's done part of it. V'im lo asa miktzato hear hair bilibo. If he hasn't done it, he's definitely thought about it.
Jimmy Carter.
V'im lo hair bilibo lasoto. Ra'a acherim sha'asu v'samach. And if he didn't think about doing it, he saw others doing it and was happy.
Suspicions do not arbitrarily arise.
What's that? Okay. So what's your take?
No, I mean, there are people who are ill and they're paranoid about everything.
He seems like he's paranoid.
But it's also, you can never imagine that somebody started a smear campaign against somebody. I mean, this is also saying, right, where there's smoke, there's fire.
Right.
It's the same thing.
But now, he lightens it up at the end when he says, well, if he didn't do it all part, and if he didn't do it at all, he thought about it, he didn't even think about it, he saw someone else do it. You know, so then it's much easier to make that case stick.
Yeah, except, you know, what he says is a man is suspected of having done something wrong only if he has indeed done so. And he's saying, right, you suspect it, so he did it. And, you know, even to the fact that he maybe once was gleeful about someone else
right.
having done it, that counts that you can be suspicious against him. I mean, you're right. It's like the hashtag Me Too.
Right.
It's like, well, someone once saw someone harassing someone else.
Right. So when I read this Gemara,
yes.
I was thinking about Yosef. Right. Yosef is wrongfully accused by Potiphar's wife of sexually harassing her, and he's thrown in jail for it.
Right.
So would he apply this to Yosef? That at one point Yosef saw someone harassing a woman and said, that looks like fun. Right? I don't know.
Yeah.
Right, so the question, how do you read... So I don't think he's saying that if you know that someone, you know, witnessed something and said, hey, I wish I could do that, that you put that person in jail. But it is a very negative view of...
Why is this here? Like, what is this?
You know what, I'm not sure of the context. I don't recall the context of it.
Right after the one you just...
I think it is, yeah. They're both from the same Gemara and Moed Katan. I have to go back and look at the context.
It's interesting because we did that whole class last year that was about actions and thoughts,
yes.
right?
Yeah.
Right.
And one leads to the other. And he's sort of saying it kind of the other way around.
Right, that's
right?
true. It's true that actions lead to thoughts, but not always. Obviously, you don't do something unless you first thought about it, and we should try to put ourselves in situations that don't lead us to be thinking about things so we don't do them. But it's not always.
Right. Well, right? That's what I'm saying, is he kind of constructed it the other way that seems so negative. Right? All last year we were talking about how you should put your thoughts a certain way
right.
so that your actions
right.
follow.
Right.
But this is making it sound like if you even once had a thought, your actions will obviously go someplace.
But no, back. I was listening to a report today that talked about this book. It's an interesting book. It's called Face Value, and it's about the fact that when you meet someone, within 3 seconds by looking at their face, you've judged them. It's important about how you dress for a job interview, Gesundheit. Politicians need to know this, and what's pardon?
Usually face and speech.
Right, but the first thing you see, right, before people normally open their mouth, right, is their face. But that's true. And he goes through the whole history of there were actually companies that would hire psychologists and psychiatrists who would look at people and say, don't hire that guy. They have, looks like a criminal, looks dishonest. Look, the Nazis did this with their Aryan look, right? So this is a very dangerous thing. And what Rustabuli is saying, if someone is accused of something, no matter what, there's something creepy about him.
Right.
Either he did it, or he thought about, at the very least, he thought about doing it. And that is... That puts a big stigma on somebody. Even if the person never did it, to even think that they thought about doing it really could stigmatize.
Every accusation is
true. To a degree. Every accusation to a degree is true. Now, by the way, this also fits into his worldview. Because if God's in charge of everything, you wouldn't be accused of something falsely. Because God's, right? Who you marry is from God. If you don't believe in God, that's going to lead you to sin, meaning... Itzhabuli really sees God, it sounds like, directing the world. And this may be a direct outgrowth of that, because it really messes around with free will. But if God is so much in control of the world and you're accused of something, well, there must be some truth in it because God's never wrong.
I just keep thinking, which is that, I think it's a Gemara where the kid is climbing up a tree to get something.
To shoo away the mother bird. His father asks him to.
Right.
He's doing two mitzvot.
Right.
Both of which in the Torah say, Leman yarichun yamecha. If you
right.
do them, you will live a long life, and he falls off the ladder and dies.
Right. And so it's sort of, you know, I'm like, how does he reconcile...
On that happy note.
How does he reconcile a world in which we all know that bad things happen to good people with this,
right.
except for
maybe
saying
he doesn't.
They somewhere in their heart
right.
were
a
bad person.
I think it's more of a joke. Like, he's saying...
You think they're mocking him?
No, I think he's just saying, like, by the end, it's, like, so broad, it's meaningless.
Meaningless, but dangerously meaningless.
It's very
then he saw others doing it. I mean, so what?
He saw others doing it and liked it.
So?
Then you're a creep. If you saw someone beating somebody up and you thought that was good, you're a creep. Let's leave kids out. Let's leave kids out. Let's talk about adults. You're right. Oh, right. Right, right. It's a dangerous thing.
Yeah.
If I think Rhoda's point is well taken. If this is serious, this is quite dangerous.
How many college boys have been falsely accused, thrown out of school, on and on and on, only
right.
later... to be proven they never did anything.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, he's an impressive man in light of his willingness to infiltrate the Roman government on behalf of the Jews.
The thing that I find interesting is all these philosophic comments of his wouldn't seem like the type of guy to think, I have to pretend not be Jewish.
Right, that's
so
right.
I can do a rational
that's right.
conversation. Why in a world where God is so
right.
intimately involved,
makes sense.
He take it upon himself to decide, I should come
That's a
head.
Great question.
Yeah.
Unless he changed, unless this is later, And he once he's found out, he realized I shouldn't meddle with God's world. Let him just do it on his own. And
it was a traumatic experience.
Yeah. Right.
I mean,
this is what's great about this. We could come up with all of these theories, which are all plausible. And until we meet Rav Reuven Estravuli after 120, we're not going to know. We may meet him. He say, "You nailed me." Or he may say, "No, here's the real me." We'll find out one day. But until then, that's it for tonight.
Thank you.
Again, no class next week. We'll pick up the week after.
I'm in Orlando.
Thank you.
We'll see you. Check all the hotels.